You are listening to the Brighton Book Club Footnotes. Thank you so much for subscribing to the podcast. If you enjoy it, we'd be so grateful if you could rate, review, subscribe and tell your friends about it. You may remember from when Lulu Allison came on to talk about the crowdfunding for her book Salt Lick, but I'm delighted to say that the book is out now with Unbound, and Lulu spoke to local journalist and bookseller Caitlin Gleeson about it.
Today I'm joined by author Lulu Allison, whose first book, Twice the Speed of Dark, was published by Unbound in 2017. Her new book, Salt Lick, is set to be released by Unbound on September 16th. Thank you for chatting with me today, Lulu.
You're welcome. Thanks for asking.
So the last time you and Anna spoke, you were in the process of publishing Salt Lick. What's it been like seeing it finalised with publication date approaching on September 16th?
Oh, it's great. The Unbound process is a really interesting one because you are basically supported by people all the way, and that's a very sort of humbling feeling. I mean, Unbound choose their books, you know, as any traditional publisher would, but, you know, listeners may or may not know that the process is from them then on crowdfunded, and it's very hard work, but it's a lovely feeling when people are backing you, and you know, you kind of it gives you a feeling that it's a little bit of a shared endeavour. So it's been great. I've really enjoyed it, but it has been quite hard work.
Yeah, I'm sure. And in terms of the book, I'll start asking some questions about that now. There's one particular paragraph you write where you say, after new employment and immigration laws bite, the workforces and wage offers no longer matched, and so the workers disappeared. The supermarkets stepped up importation, and as they imported more, less was provided within the national borders. Can we interpret this as an allegory for Brexit, what we're currently seeing with certain shortages and less seasonal workers?
Yes. That was very much part of the context. I was already writing it in 2016, and it just seemed to me that this kind of there was a disassociation from our connection to something as fundamental as food production, which seemed, you know, another part of the craziness of Brexit to me. And I felt like there's a real hubris in not thinking that you need to be able to provide food where you are. And already, you know, I mean, it wasn't me who predicted that there'd be difficulties. It was predicted by untold people. And and a couple of years ago, maybe, I can't remember, maybe even a year ago, a government minister actually posited that we don't really need farms at all, we could import all of our food. And it just seems to me absolutely crazy that food could be so much of a commodity that you would let go of the means of its production so entirely. You know, it just seems unnatural, really, as well.
Absolutely. And so throughout the book you have this chorus, as you call it, and it's written as short poems between some of the paragraphs in the novel. It's used as a break from the narrative but carries with the story. What was your vision for how that would be read and interpreted?
Yeah, it's kind of quite a tricky question, that, because I didn't know, just knew I always wanted a chorus, and I didn't know it was going to be cows either. It was one of those things that sort of wormed its way out by itself, really. But I think that what it is that I had this sort of picture of the land sort of stretching out all the way around the protagonist. And I wanted something that kind of would do the same through time, because it seems impossible to sort of dislocate the connection to land from the time and the history and the repetition. And so I wanted a voice that would kind of make that connection and would be like almost like the weather, you know, floating above any kind of human conventions of national border, and you know, something much more fundamental, and a basic as our connection to the land, because we grow food. And the cows seemed really interesting because they obviously have been at one point wild, and they've been changed and changed and changed, and you know, as they've become domesticated and farm animals. And I really like that you know, that seemed to me to be have quite a good resonance with this idea of the unnatural disconnection between human animals and the land that they should be feeding themselves with. So yeah, I wanted them to be a kind of connecting general voice, really, and not, you know, the chorus is perfect for that, because the chorus kind of just commentates and interacts. They don't really drive the plot in any way, so that's why I used them.
Yeah, absolutely. And so in terms of, you say they sort of, they carry on with your characters, one of the main characters, Jesse, who, and I quote, dreams all day of a woodland patch of sun and the chance to play with his new friend. You obviously started writing this book, as you say, in 2016, before the effects of the pandemic would become clear, and indeed, you know, before any of that was in anyone's mind. But this kind of sentiment would be well and truly understood by many by now. How do you feel your character's experience might be read in light of the last 18 months?
Well, it's been a bit strange, actually, because quite, you know, there's a pandemic, well, there's two pandemics in Salt Lake, I wrote them before the actual pandemic as well, and so it's kind of, you know, I had to go back in with the knowledge of actually how a pandemic works.
Yeah.
A few details here and there to make sense, but there's been a couple of things that have been happening, you know, the Brexit thing we just talked about, and the kind of lack of people to work on farms, and also the Black Lives Matter movement has sort of highlighted for everybody the dangers of white nationalism, and there's a thread of that through the book as well. You know, I wanted to explore racism, but obviously from the point of view, being a white person, from the point of view of white people, you know, what is it that makes people nationalistic? Mm-hmm. And so that was just an idea I had because I was thinking about a time when the right is sort of the right, the government has become more right wing, populism has risen, mm-hmm. and people feel less inhibited about expressing those kind of pretty grim opinions. And I wanted to explore that. And so, so politically and socially, the Black Lives Matter movement has kind of highlighted that for everybody as well. And so that kind of, it came into sort of sharp focus. I mean, obviously it was always there, and many, many people have been doing that work, you know, without that kind of level of kind of public awareness, perhaps. But, you know, that was another aspect of the book that sort of seemed to come into a little bit of focus since I wrote it. But, yeah, it's kind of, it seems important to me to reflect, you know, I just wanted to reflect the kind of muddle of human existence. It sort of goes along, and things happen, and people make the best of it, and people thrive, and then other people don't. And it's always this ongoing story, and that's why I've always described it as being not a dystopia, but further down the wrong road. You know, and quite a lot of that going down that wrong road seems to have actually happened.
Yeah,
you know? So it's been quite strange.
And I suppose in the light of the pandemic, and as you say, all these social issues going on, people have really reflected inwards on themselves. And a lot of people have chosen to appreciate the natural world more.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's absolutely true. And I've very much done it myself. But I also didn't quite want to kind of propose, you know, being deep into nature as some kind of, you know, Eden-like innocent existence. You know, there's a part when one of the central characters is older. She finds a group of people who are self-sufficiently living on a farm, and she finds it quite overbearing. You know, the kind of collective thinking and the kind of clipped order that people keep because they're working on this together, you know. She misses the kind of the chaos and the vibrance of the city that she's come from. So I didn't want to be too kind of clear on a sort of on a moral judgment about the city versus the countryside, but I did want to kind of highlight the what's seems to me the mistaken idea of retreating too far from it. You know, we need to know that, that side of, we are animals, and we need a sort of a reflection of that animal existence in our everyday lives. And the further you get from your own food production, the more you're pretending that you're not an animal, you know, and it seems crazy.
Yeah. And I mean, you say, you, as you say, you, you talk about the natural world. Obviously, you, everybody has a connection to the natural world, but there must have been research involved in kind of mapping the areas that you used in the book, because your characters cover quite a lot of physical ground. What did you do to sort of to discover the routes that they go on?
Well, I've never been to Suffolk, but I just always thought I wanted Isolde to leave London going north, and so I went to Suffolk for a long weekend, you know, because I couldn't quite bear to write without any knowledge, you know, I didn't want to make it up. So I took a trip and just sort of got to sit for myself, and I did loads of street view journeys, you know, I kind of
the Google Maps tour.
Yeah, exactly, and kind of, you know, kind of places where she would go off the road and how it might have overgrown and how, you know, where there were houses, where there were fields, and I did loads of, and I also did loads of loads of maps of predicted sea level rises, which was quite daunting. Because, you know, obviously it's in a future where you know, probably we haven't managed to deal with the environmental crisis, and so, you know, some of the land, it starts with a description of the sea eating the edges of the land. So I did quite a lot of that, and kind of had to then remap when I would see where the sea had come to and rethink it through. So it was quite fun, but I'm not particularly good at research. You know, I'll always prefer to make it up if I can. But I did want to actually see the land I was talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, in Sussex, we're in quite a unique geographical area. We've got the beaches, the city, farmland. What is it about Sussex and or Brighton that influences you personally as a writer?
I'm not sure that it. I can't sort of quite spot any direct influences in a way. I mean, it's a nice place to be because of all those things you mentioned. But I definitely would say Woodvale Cemetery influences me. Like, I live quite near there, and I spend a lot of time. I actually do quite a fair bit of writing in Woodvale, you know, because I really, it's just so beautiful, and that I find really. I find it quite soothing, actually, you know, to kind of remember that mortality and just sort of, you know, get to grips with it, and to kind of have that sense of things going on and evolving and rolling over. And I think that ends up being, you know, a bit of a common thread in my writing, the sort of things that they're cycles and they just keep turning and they keep going and our story keeps happening in different ways. And, you know, and I think that's, I don't know, that always fascinates me. And so being in a cemetery, especially one as beautiful as Woodvale Cemetery, is quite a nice way to link to that, I think. You know, all these people had lives and were loved and, you know,
absolutely,
were mourned and everything, you know, so...
It's a must give you a lot of creative inspiration to be surrounded by that kind of circle of life.
Yeah, absolutely it does. Yeah, because I think, you know, it's a bit, I think it, sort of in a way it goes back to the cow chorus, that idea of them having a kind of herd memory that's stretched back with their kind of, into their ancient DNA, you know, a different kind of consciousness. And I think we probably do have that consciousness of, you know, we are just a little story, we're a little spark, and, you know, there are millions of these little sparks, and they're all vital, and they're all completely insignificant. You know, it's a really strange balance. You know, nothing. You know, one life doesn't matter, but all lives matter. You know, it's a very. I think it's a very interesting place to write from, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for everyone listening, we'd love to hear you read a section of the novel.
Yeah. Well, I've got a section which is part of Isolde's walk. She walks for 2 days to try and find people on a farm, and she meets Lee on the way, who's run away from one of the white towns, which are the white nationalist settlements. And this is a little section when they are about halfway along their journey. And they're actually, it's I don't specify, but it's loosely based on Chelmsford.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and the premise is that, you know, quite a lot of small towns have more or less been abandoned as people move to cities.
Yeah.
Okay. They see no one else as they walk through the town. Their feet crunch on fallen leaves, tread silently on moss. Pavement glimpsed in skeins below nature's first claiming veil. In a brick pedestrian way lies a jumble of letters from shop signage. Some of the letters are laid out in a line but spell nothing. Bright plastic and metal dulled by weather, leaves and webs tucked into the spars between capital E, groundsel growing through the hole of a turquoise O, a wordless babble of retreat. A street away, sunshine hits a crumbling cement lattice. The brutalist chevrons encasing the long side wall of the multi-storey car park, Apache, as though at one time subject to a sustained spray of gunfire. A few cars rust in the shade. One corner is wound with a spiral ramp connecting the five levels. Whether for some unknowable practicality, or for the sheer joy of having the town as a playscape, an extravagant thickly knotted rope walkway connects the fourth floor of the car park and a big open window high in the side of an office building. The office workers are long gone, as is now also the bridge builder. On the first level of the car park, unseen by Isolde and Lee, a missing chunk of cement opens up a sunny patch of concrete floor. A wolf basks in the sun, yawns and rises, disappears briefly into the shadow and appears once more between the yellow pay barriers. She walks carelessly, stopping to listen and smell. Small animal cues from the hordes of birch marching slowly, slowly into the centre, youngest first. She carries on her way. At the crossing, she casts a glance at the back of the male and female walking north through the town. The big pads of her feet skirt the broken glass of a jewellery store, chains and trinkets glinting alongside the glass, as though the valueless futility of such easy wealth hit the thief suddenly during the execution of the raid. As though in a dream, seeded by genetic memory, a dog barks, distantly, whining in fear or in terrible longing.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for reading that. No, it's excellent.
No worries.
So, as we said, the book's out on September 16th. Where can we find the book?
You can find it anywhere. Certainly available to order from Waterstones or any independent bookshop, and any of the usual online retailers.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for chatting to me today. I hope you get lots of positive feedback for your book. It sounds like you definitely will. And
thank you so much.
All the best with your future writing.
Thank you very much. All the best. Thank you.
Thank you.